This episode is brought to you by our Patreons. Please check out the Patreon page on patreon.com/boiledleatheraudiohour and consider supporting the podcast. Hello everyone and welcome to the Boiled Leather Audio Hour. This is your illustrious host, Stefan Sasse, and I am today with another equally illustrious co-host who will now produce himself to the fore.
Hello, good to be back.
Who are you, sir? You are mysterious, like a mystery knight riding on the battlefield.
I'm Stephen Atwell of Race for the Iron Throne.
And that should serve as an introduction for everyone. Stephen has been with this podcast for several times now, right? I mean, at least three times you were on the program. So for the old hands in our audience, you're already very well known. And for everyone else, check out his blog if you don't know him. And if you don't know him, shame on you, because he really is one of the authorities in fandom. So today we are going back to Fire and Blood. I started this series basically with Sean T. Collins, my regular, now irregular co-host. And tonight we are talking about policy, basically. So going full nerd circle. And I think it will revolve mostly around Jaehaerys and his very long reign, right?
Yeah, just because, you know, there's like something like 300 pages out of Fire and Blood are just on Jaehaerys. And, you know, those chapters cover tons of stuff, but they also tend to cover public policy in a way that we don't really get in like the Dance of the Dragons or like Aenys and Maegor. You know, there's not really a lot there. That's more sort of interpersonal struggle and war and stuff like that. But you know, I'm still like, I've read the whole book. I'm still not through writing up all of the essays about it. But one of the things that kind of motivated me going into the Fire and Blood book was to get a more in-depth understanding of how, you know, this world of Westeros works in a political sense. And, you know, does the world building that, you know, we got a lot more of in Fire in World of Ice and Fire, does it hold up when it sort of zooms in with Fire and Blood? And, you know, there's a lot more material in here. We learn a lot of things. Not all of them make the most sense. There are some frustrating open questions, and I hope that's what we get into today.
So just to get back into review mode, are you mostly satisfied, or at least a little bit satisfied, with the image of the inner workings of the cogs and screws of Westeros? Or would you say this is more or less a frustrating experience in this sense, at least?
I would say it's kind of a mix. There are some things that seem to hold together better than others. There are these sort of frustrating lacuna, even in the middle of additional detail. And then there's a lot of unanswered questions where, like, there was stuff that I was hoping to find out and didn't get an answer to.
Hey, because my general impression right now from the, fallout is too strong a word, but from the general reception of the book right now in fandom, if I browse the tumblers, it seems like people are lukewarm on it. People criticize it for different reasons. I mean, you are going in, a lot of the policy doesn't really make sense. Then you have the angle of like Jim is doing it, the battles of the Dance with Dragons don't really make sense. Then you have Good Queen Alicent going on about the role of women and the over-reliance on death in childbed and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But there is an unusual amount of criticism going around, I feel, about this book in comparison to the series proper, you know?
Yeah, I think part of the issue is that, you know, with the series proper, the world building exists to, you know, set the stage for the characters, right? And what we're really pulled forwards by is the arcs of the characters. You know, whether your favorite, you know, whether you're into Jon Snow or Tyrion or Daenerys or Sansa or whoever, like, you know, even, you know, you can ignore what you don't care about and just focus on the stuff that matters most to that character. Whereas, you know, with World of Ice and Fire and Fire and Blood, it's kind of all, like, even though I think you can see in Fire and Blood, like, Martin starting to sort of strain a little bit against that, it's all world building. Like, he definitely wants to turn it more into a narrative in some places, where you get, like, some suspiciously full-length dialogue in conversations that normally wouldn't have been recorded. And you sort of wonder, like, you know, was there a scribe in the, like, the one that springs to my mind is, like, when Rogar is, like, yelling at Rayella, and she's yelling at him. Like, was there a scribe in the corner, you know, taking notes on Bartian? Like, how do you, you know, who sits down and writes all that?
I'm always getting the impression in these cases that it's more or less like those exact transcriptions of the speeches that the antiquity generals and statesmen are supposed to have made. You know, like in ancient Greece,
there's
someone who is chiseling away on a piece of stone like while the guy is talking. I always had the feeling that this is basically an invention by Jill Dane whoever's writing.
I think that's just as true as of, you know, Thucydides as it is for Gildane. It's like, you know, it's, I think, loosely based on what was said, but a lot of it is sort of like, okay, you know, if everyone involved could have sat down and, like, had a few drafts of what their remarks could be, this is what they should have said. So I think part of the frustration is just that, you know, Fire and Blood is more kind of all world building. And that makes the potential shortcomings a little bit more naked, harder to disguise.
You can't say the narrative demands it, right? Because there is no narrative.
Yeah. You know, some things that kind of struck to my mind. One of the things I found kind of frustrating early in the story of Jaehaerys, although this is for, you know, very personal reasons, I was kind of disappointed by the sort of the end of the story of the Faith Militant, because it's one of the few places in Westerosi history in which the small folk are really active players. And, you know, Septon Moon especially is, like, dispatched very unceremoniously. And that happens again during the Dance of the Dragons with the Shepherd, where, like, likewise, he's there and gone. And in a series that doesn't have a lot of working class characters, it's like you could have done more with that potentially. The funny thing is, because there's this and there's World of Ice and Fire, we kind of have, like, in the way that you do with history, right, conflicting accounts. So the reconciliation of the faith, probably one of the most important things that Jaehaerys ever does, right? In the books, there's this, like, high-level negotiation between Septon, Barth, and the High Septon about, like, okay, is the faith going to have judicial autonomy? Is it going to have an army? Okay, no, but, you know, here in exchange, the church is going to defend the faith, and so on and so forth. And here you get this very romantic scene of Joffrey Doggett, who was one of the leaders of the Faith Militant, becoming a member of the Kingsguard. And it's like, then the reconciliation happens when, like, Jaehaerys is, like, what, 12, 13, something like that? Just like a young man at the very beginning of his career, and you're sort of like, that's it? That's all it took? You know, you just had this massive civil war, and all it took was a little bit of PR? So I kind of missed, like, in some places, that level of attention to statecraft. Although later on, when the High Septon dies, and there's that whole description of, like, Jaehaerys and Barth scheming to, like, arrange the nomination of his successor, and they're working out a deal with the Hightowers because the Hightowers are incredibly influential within the faith, and they have their own candidate. You know, that's more what I was looking for in that moment.
Yeah, sometimes Martin channels his inner Aaron Sorkin, you know, where you have, like in The West Wing, when you have episodes that really realistically describe the tear of daily policy grinding, and then suddenly he decides, ah, oh, fuck it, and Bartlett gives a major speech, and you have the swelling of music, and everyone is, yeah, let's do that.
Exactly, yeah. That's a very good description.
Those don't always mix. And given that we don't have the swelling music and the rapid-fire dialogue and all of that, those moments stick out more, I guess. This comes with this territory of the fake history. It has drawbacks, and I think writing Fire and Blood as opposed to writing The World of Ice and Fire, Martin is at the same time more aware of those, like, because he now has more experience in writing in this specific genre, and at the same time is going in the fuck it mode more often, simply because he knows the inherent limitations. I had this feeling that when he published the novellas and The World of Ice and Fire, he tried more harder to separate those two, you know, to keep the style of the prose in the series itself more distinct from pure world-building stuff, go more into this fake history thing. And at some level, I think he just now ignores when it doesn't really mesh.
I mean, it's kind of interesting because there's moments in which he thinks a lot more about historiography in this book. Like, you really, really get a sense of, like, okay, there's different scholars with different, you know, perspectives, and he talks about, like, well, they're these books, but they were written then, and, like, you know, there were plagiarized copies, and so, you know, the whole business with the caution for young women. You know, I sort of wonder in some places, like, man, you know, what George R. R. Martin really should have done is, like, have the printing press be in his world already, because in some ways the kind of literary culture that he wants to have only exists in the wake of that, but it doesn't exist. So, but you know, I as a historian, I like the historiography side of it. It made it feel a little bit more real, as opposed to this sort of, like, you know, there's somehow these sort of omniscient chroniclers who are, you know, at hand in every discussion, and we know, you know, the history of, like, thousands and thousands of years ago, despite the fact that, like, you know, it probably would have been written in another language, and, you know, Samuel Tarly doesn't seem to know that language. So yeah, that's a little bit better, but I think you're right. Like, at a certain point, he just kind of goes fuck it, and just wants to write his narrative. Especially, like, the scene where, like, Jaehaerys and Alysanne face down Rogar and Alyssa at Dragonstone is, like, that swelling music moment.
Yeah, that seems like a lot of here the song really dissolves into the history. You know, you can't separate the two anymore. I mean, we have those in our history books as well, especially in the more popular ones, where you have stuff like take the Cuban Missile Crisis, where it just takes the brilliance and composure of a John F. Kennedy and he stares down the Russians, you know, stuff like that. And if you look a little bit deeper, you see no, it's way more complicated than that, and I think we are just obviously missing out on the more complicated version because we don't have historians going into the source texts. But I definitely agree, he really would like this, and at certain points he just ignores that he doesn't have the printing press.
But, you know, in terms of getting into the politics like we say we would, one thing that I was kind of surprised is that, you know, in World of Ice and Fire, it's described that Jaehaerys had the first small council, like the first formal small council. And we don't really see that, right? We don't get this, like, moment where, like, he puts everyone around a table for the first time or something like that. Or, you know, decides, like, who's on the small council and who's not. 'Cause there's interesting things like, you know, in his small council, the commander of the city watch is a member. Right. And that's something that changes because, you know, by the time that Song of Ice and Fire starts, that's not the case. Right. Janna Slint is not initially on the small council. So I'm sort of like, one of those questions that's still open is, like, OK, when did that change? What made it change?
Yeah, I think those little questions, I'm not sure if he even notices stuff like that or if he cares. I mean, it could come up in Fire and Blood Volume 2. But what we see here, I think, is I have encountered the same problem in other fake histories of fantasy and science fiction worlds. Because as a trained historian, I'm also constantly seeing this prop up in those accounts. And I think a lot of it is owed to the basic decision of writing these things in chronological order. You know, a historian usually wouldn't do that. You would go like, oh, there are certain topics. For example, we take the reign of Jaehaerys and we look at the actual policy making, like the small council and the relations to the lords and yada, yada, yada. And then you would make up a separate account of his relationship with Essos, foreign relations, basically, or things like that. But since he is still writing mostly in chronological order and still trying to create a narrative This goes, I think, almost without a chance not to do it at the cost of cohesiveness in terms of these details.
I think you're absolutely right about that. One of the things that made writing about Fire and Blood a little bit difficult is that there are each of the chapters bounce between lots of different topics. So it's hard to sort of separate that stuff out. Like one of the things that I noticed, for example, is the Septon Barth's like public works. Like that's in several different chapters. So like having to smoosh all of that together, and like especially when I'm writing this up and I'm like, oh right, the you know, the roads are in a different chapter than the sewer system. Why is that? Seems like you could have just, you know, moved that, you know, one section over to another. You know, but it is, you know, I think interesting to talk about, you know, because we do get a little bit, you know, we get a little bit more of the detail. Like, so for example, we now know the, like, the difference in tax policy between regency of Rhaegar Baratheon and, like, Jaehaerys's majority, because, like, he brings in Rego Draws, right? And so he shifts from a sort of taxation-based fiscal policy to borrowing, and, you know, sort of has this weird interaction where, like, the theft of these dragon eggs leads to, you know, a big debt being forgiven, and so, like, he sort of has, like, this big fiscal boost without necessarily having to pay for it. Or he changes taxation from being based on, like, just exports and imports out of King's Landing to, like, a general luxury tax and a crenellation tax, which I thought was like, oh, that's really clever. And but it you know, the thing is, with all of these details, once you introduce them, right, you then set up questions for, like, okay, so what changed later, right? Why is it that we don't talk about crenellation taxes later? You know, why wouldn't this come up during the you know, the reign of Aerys the Second or something like this? Or my favorite example is, like, when we're talking about the public works in the in King's Landing, especially the sewer system. And when I, you know, what I wrote was, like, I find it peculiar that, like, King's Landing is still described as, like, dirtier and smellier than other Westerosi cities, despite these investments in public health. And I was like, well, did they just not work? Were they damaged later on? Like, that's a potential explanation, right? You know, there was the storming of the Dragon Pit, there was the sack of King's Landing. You know, there's all potential opportunities where, like, you know, especially, you know, anytime where you've got, like, a sewage and water system, right? You break enough pipes and all of a sudden the whole thing starts breaking down. So it's like you've now created more work for yourself in a certain sense, because you now need to explain things later on.
Or not.
And then you're like, okay, but, you know, you can't have things be in one place and then not in another, because it leads to all kinds of logical questions. My, you know, sort of speaking of Good Queen Alysanne, like, one of the things that came up to me about, you know, all the deaths in childbirth is I was thinking, but we know Tansy Tea exists in this world, and that people know it exists. So wouldn't we see more active use of birth control, especially among older women, where there's more of a danger of, you know, a childbirth being serious threat to their health? You know, you can't have a background detail be present and not present. It's sort of like, you know, if there was, like, a standing army in one of these chapters and then not in, you know, the main series, you'd be like, wait, what's happening with that? Where did that go? So I think that's sort of one of the benefits and drawbacks of doing this kind of fake history, is that once you set up some, like, interesting bit of detail, you now have to kind of pay that off almost in, like, a Chekhov's gun kind of way.
It also creates story problems, because just as you are mentioning the whole public sewage system of King's Landing, you know, if there is such a system, and we get, if I count the show as canon 2 for this, we get twice the instance where a major siege is basically solved by infiltrating the sewage system, you know, once in Meereen, and then in the storming of Castle Rock in the show, where they're using the sewers. So if King's Landing has sewers, where are they in the Clash of Kings? You know,
Davos. Why didn't someone try to use those?
This would be the first thing for Davos Seaworth, master smuggler to use all the time, basically, to go in and out of King's Landing, especially if they're broken down and not in use anymore.
And there's actually a good historical example of this in Seattle. Seattle has all of these underground tunnel networks that were used by various criminal organizations back in the day. Smugglers, rum runners during Prohibition, ship captains shanghaiing sailors to like forcibly work for them.
That explains a lot of and, run, actually.
Yeah, so, you know, okay, you know, if they're there, they're there, and people know how to use them. Speaking of a thing that kind of like broke my brain a little bit, the population growth under Jaehaerys. Yeah, doubling, where I was like, okay, like, you know, I thought the math of Westerosi population and army numbers was confusing before. Now it's even more confusing because all of a sudden the population of Westeros doubles, and yet somehow all of the armies in the Dance of Dragons are way smaller than the armies that existed during the conquest of Westeros. Like, what happened? You know, did the population double and then half? You know, but even that doesn't, you know, we were having problems before. Now there's this doubling, which, you know, one of the things that I wrote about was like, this is a little bit implausible, not from the idea that you couldn't have a period of sustained prosperity, but, you know, leading to increased births, because that absolutely does happen. It's more that, you know, the relatively short time frame is a bit of a problem, because human biology doesn't change when the economy is good, right? It still takes a certain amount of time for one generation to be born, grow to sexual maturity, and have kids of their own. Like, that can't be compressed, really.
True enough. Those are the kind of problems. And it, just to hark back to the sewers once more, the thing is, you run into the problem of creating this coherent world in which people are using the sewers of King's Landing and Old Town and yada, yada, yada all the time, and not repeating yourself narratively. If this just becomes the golden, I don't know, how do you call it, like a golden key to every city, basically.
Yeah.
He would have to explain in every other battle why are we not using the sewers, and this becomes really bad for the narrative.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think you could come up with explanations like, okay, if sewers get used in sieges, you know, that often, right, people are going to put portcullises in the sewer system to make sure that you can't do that. You know, maybe they wall them up after a siege, and that's why the sewers aren't there. Like, you know, it just, I think it's not necessarily that all of this is inherently unworkable. It just, you have to put in the work. Speaking of which, one of the things that I found frustrating is when we get to the Jaehaerys's code, his legal code. You know, this is clearly based on Justinian's creation of the Code Justinianus, and like everything about the process is really interesting, but we don't get the internal content, right? We don't know what the Code of Jaehaerys was. You know, now I personally think that, you know, even as like a, you know, a historian, not about world building, like I don't think you need to sit down and write out a whole legal code from scratch, but like at least tell us how it differs. And the big unanswered question is, we don't know how it was enforced. You know, the one world building detail about this stuff that you told us before is that, you know, the lords have the right in pit and gallows. How do these two things intersect? They've got to be some conflict there. So, you know, it's just like, you've got to do the payoff if you do the setup.
There's also this very Sorkin moment of good Queen Alicent talking to the whore in Moldstown and thereby discovering the law of the first night.
Yeah, it reminded me specifically of that one episode, the Pro-Am tour, where the first lady is like, you know, discovers child slavery by talking to a school kid who like raised money to buy a pen pal out of debt slavery in India. And it is sort of like, okay, yeah, it's sort of like, you know, but First Night is, you know, practiced on Dragonstone all the time. So you knew this existed. What's I guess a little bit stranger is, why is this a particularly northern custom? Like, that wasn't there before, and all of a sudden it's like, okay, it's in the north and nowhere else? like, wouldn't this have come up in the Riverlands or the Crownlands or, you know, the Westerlands or like any, or the Reach, like any of the other progresses that you've done before? Why here and now? Even when you sort of set aside the slightly Sorkin-esque thing of like, okay, you know, we know Alisan is like wonderful and bringing more people into the political process who weren't there before, but like, would a medieval queen really have like gone to a brothel? I feel like that's, you know, that's pushing the bounds of what the society would consider appropriate.
I have the feeling that this specific northern accent that the story gets is a retcon from A Dance with Dragons, because it popped up there, right, in the discussions of Bolton and as a Roose Bolton and Theon, when he tells him, like, oh, we're still doing it. It was outlawed by Jaehaerys, but the north, blah, blah, blah. You know, it was a nice world-building detail in A Dance with Dragons, showing that the North has deep traditional roots, and to muddy the picture a little bit, not to have the Northmen be the good guys all the time. And
yeah,
then he had to follow it up basically in Fire and Blood. That's the feeling I get.
Those are sort of some of my big world building quibbles. I haven't yet gotten to the chapters of the Dance of the Dragons, which I have to say is kind of only marginally improved. This is more sort of Jim's stuff. But, you know, the war is still not really as interesting as other conflicts in history, despite that it has to play a rather large role in, you know, in terms of the sort of like consequential nature of it in eliminating the dragons and like reshaping the relationship of the Targaryen monarchy to the nobility of Westeros. But it's still not the best plotted, I would argue.
No, not at all. And picking up your favorite topic of Team Smallfolk, it seems weird to me that a war that is so singularly devastating to the Smallfolk in terms of this terror from above, you know, this Vietnam War imagery of dragons coming from the sky and burning villages and hovels and harvests and all of that.
Cities, yeah.
And there is seemingly no repercussion against the Targaryen regime, especially, you know, you would expect like the common people really souring on the Dracocracy, now I've got it,
yeah.
Especially. And of course, the lords as well. But with the lords, you have some people who profit on both sides. So there it is, a little less pronounced and more interwoven with the political plots and fortunes and all that kind of stuff. But the small folk really should, there should be some kind of reaction to the Targaryen demigods, which they seem to have been before, that are now like
mortal men,
the
yeah.
Shepherd, you know, this the sentiment that the shepherd has, like those are devils and they fly monsters and we need to kill them all. I would expect a little bit more of that, especially in the Riverlands. But there
what's strange is not so much that there's no interaction there, because we do get the shepherd. It's just that it's very brief. Like it's an interruption from the status quo that then goes away. And you know what I was thinking was like, okay, but like you look back to history and there's all kinds of examples of like failed peasant rebellions, but they usually have some sort of after effect, right? You have, you know, the great peasant revolt and it's crushed, but serfdom doesn't come back, right? That's the long-term result, is that like everyone, you know, the nobles win, but they know that like, okay, we don't want to push things too far, so we'll allow serfdom to fade away. Or, you know, like how you get the creation of parliament, or, you know, various legal structures like that. Like it would be interesting to see more of that kind of long-term institutional change a little bit. So one of the things, to sort of wrap up with a discussion of the regency, I kind of like the political maneuverings a little bit, and I found myself in some ways like my sympathies were moving in directions that I didn't expect, because, you know, Unwin Peak is clearly meant to be a villain. Like, he's a bit of a stage villain. But I found myself surprisingly sympathetic to him because of how much of a fuck up with good publicity the Oakenfist was.
Yeah.
Like, all of his victories are kind of like, either they're not really victories in the long term, or, you know, he finds himself pushing against an open door and like gets all the credit, and like Unwin Peak is there like, hey, I'm trying to run the government, and you're just fucking with me, and why am I the bad guy? I was like, you know what? Okay, he's a bastard. you know, he probably ordered the murder of children, but like, you put yourself in his steps and you would be really frustrated, you know, with Oakenfist and the other regents who are like probably, you know, as vain and corrupt as Unwin Peak, but he happened to be the, you know, the crab that was, you know, closest to getting out of the bucket.
Yeah, he is set up as a fall guy, basically. When you read about him, you have this whole feeling like he will lose. He has a giant sign over his head, like, kick me. And he's just waiting for it, basically. I can't even tell you why, but he's just written in this way, you know? A little bit like Cersei's political machinations. You can just see them fail before your eyes. You know that this marriage scheme will not work, etc., etc.
Yeah, and the other thing that I thought was kind of interesting, if you look at the book as a whole, is, wow, Regents do not end up well. Like, they just, none of them ever, you know, survive, their political career particularly survives this. And it sort of makes you wonder a little bit. I mean, we see a similar phenomenon in Song of Ice and Fire. You know, Ned goes, Cersei goes, Tywin goes. You know, I can't imagine that Mace Tyrell is going to enjoy a long and successful political career. You'd think there would be more trepidation on the part of some of these people, like, or at least people mentioning, like, you know, okay, they're the regent, they've got all the power, but, like, we know what happens to regents in the long run.
Yeah, okay, but the same is true of Harrenhal and other stuff. I mean, the regency is just such a big prize, and I think the temptation of saying, like, it will be different with me, you know, this time is different.
Yeah.
We know it from economic policy. This time is different. Austerity will totally work this time. So,
yeah, well, I mean, we could probably say the same about, like, any political office, right? You know, most presidencies end in frustration. Like, second terms are never as successful as first terms. So why do people keep running for re-election? You know, most prime ministerial careers end in failure in one form or another. But, like, you know, people gotta, you know, climb the slippery pole. They gotta reach for the brass ring, whatever the metaphor is. So, you know, maybe that's one of the more accurate observations of Westerosi politics.
I think actually it is. And I think Martin is a good writer in that regard, you know, that he shows the different levels at which government operates and how the incentives of people are. This is one thing about this Unwin Peak episode. You can just see how many different veto points and influence players exist within this supposed monarchy in which one guy is in charge, you know, and even if it is only a regent, but there are so many people who can throw a wrench in your gears, and this is the same in every whether it be it a regency or a reign proper, and all those people can fuck up your day. And I think the Unwin Peak episode is on the one hand very realistic in that regard, and on the other hand very instructive because it gives you this feeling of how it ends. And the same thing is true about Gratitude, you know. I mean, Manderly is doing his good enough
job.
Oh
yeah,
and then
he
Aegon
really
the third
gets
comes
screwed
in
over.
And like, yeah, go fuck yourself.
I have to say, like, you know, speaking of sympathy shifting, like, I really felt less sympathy for Aegon the Third. I was like, you know, dude, you just, you know, okay, Unwin Peak was a bastard, but, like, Manderly was doing the right thing. Like, he was making the right moves, and you just kind of fucked it up, you know, for really no reason. And, you know, that actually makes me look forward to Volume 2 a little bit, is, you know, maybe we're going to get, depending on when the book comes out, like, a little bit more explanation of, like, what led his reign to be so troubled that he became known as Aegon the Broken.
Yeah, now there is not much hinting of it. And I have to say, I wouldn't have expected me to say, I'm really excited for the reign of Aegon the Third. And this is my big surprise from the book, because I'm really interested in what happened there. Because the guy really seems to not have it together in all the ways that one should have. I mean, you can understand it looking at his upbringing and the people he surrounds himself with, and this whole episode about him him being besieged in Magor's Holdfast, and this has to do something with you, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean, I can definitely see, like, how it would shape his psychology, that he's just this sort of, you know, paranoid, depressive, you know, doesn't really have anyone around him he can trust, doesn't have any kind of social skills, which you need if you're, you know, if everything is based on the charisma of the ruler. But it would be interesting to see, like, what did he screw up? And because, you know, he wasn't, in many ways, like, he was the first monarch who had to deal with a political system founded on, you know, Dracocracy without dragon. And there must have been moments where he tried to exercise royal authority and just be told by some powerful noble, like, no, you can't make me. Yeah, so, yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
That would be the really interesting part, you know, how they change their ruling style. And people like Aegon IV, for example, will also play a major role in that. One thing that I wanted to add about our whole public works, etc., and the thing of the Dance with Dragons changing the small folks' perceptions, Aegon V is actually a good way to retcon all of that. So he could have basically written there is a 100-year period in which the people do not like the Targaryens that much, and then Aegon V basically repairs that. It would run counter to some stuff from the novellas where we don't see this really, but given the hatred of Brynden, Brynden Rivers later, that might overshadow things or something like that.
Yeah, well, you know, Aegon V is one of those things that I would really like to find out about, because it's another one of these historical questions, right? What were his reforms that were later reversed? You know, how did that change people's thinking? Is Aegon V an example of a monarch who was unpopular among the nobility but loved by the small folk? And how did that sort of shape the Targaryen monarchy going forwards? Like, did they have more of a popular base of support than they'd had in the past? You know, and I mean, we sort of see that a little bit in Song of Ice and Fire, right, where, like, even someone as monstrous as Aerys II is, like, you know, there's some small folk who are nostalgic for his reign, in part because he usually sort of confined his monstrous attentions to the nobility, right? He wasn't, you know, sacking entire villages and putting them to the torch. He was, like, you know, going after a particular noble families and saying, like, okay, I want their tongues ripped out or their hearts burned on a fire or whatever.
Yeah, which is okay if you do it to small folk, right? Because that's basically the Bolton, the Bolton rule, a quiet land, a peaceful people, right? If you take out your staking and heart burning and all that kind of stuff on a small folk, basically no one cares. But if you do it to nobles, he just got it the wrong way, basically.
All right, well, that's about all I got. You know, I've been I unfortunately have not been able to put a lot of work into Fire and Blood recently. I'm teaching a new course this next semester, and that always requires a lot more setup. So I think I will sign off and get back to that.
Yeah,
because I have my first departmental meeting this week, and you need to be sufficiently prepped for that. But it's been very good talking to you.
Yeah, thank you for your time, and hopefully if anyone has any questions left, which they hopefully won't, but if they do, they could check out your Tumblr and use your Ask Me Anything.
Oh,
right?
Absolutely. Yeah, so you can find me at Race for the Iron Throne at WordPress, or Race for the Iron Throne at Tumblr, or you can tweet at me at Stephen Atwell on Twitter.
Then thanks for your time, and I hope I will be seeing you much sooner than the last time around, because it's like at least 2 years since we last talked, and next time hopefully will come sooner. So thank you again for your time. Bye-bye.
Bye.